Thank you, Gay, and I'm sure that we'll all acknowledge the great contribution and knowledge that Gay is able to share with us, because it's something that we say over here, but it's always good to get another voice to come and also share the similar experiences from an international perspective to what we share over here, and to bring hope to what we're trying to achieve over here. Gay has offered to respond to any questions, and I'm sure that there are many questions. Rod's the first, second cab off the rank. I'll go first. Gay, I'm just wondering now, you've been over here, you've been to Victoria and now here in Sydney. You've learnt a bit about the intervention that's happening in the Northern Territory and some of the issues. What happens now? How do you take this forward, or do you take it forward, or is it really just an information collection process for you?
As
Aboriginal people, I hope that with the new government in place that we're going to hopefully negotiate a new arrangement or treaty or whatever they want to call it. And I've facilitated processes where, you know, Aboriginal people have engaged, but you know, the issues like human rights, Bill of Rights, sovereignty, representation, political life, changing the constitution, how the states fit in, how our nation groups fit in, and they're all very complex issues, well above most of the people that are in those forums. How do we get access to the sort of expertise we might need when we go into those negotiations to help us work our way through the past for the future? And any thoughts on that?
In fact, I don't think you need a facilitator. I'll just let you find the people up here.
Okay, maybe there's another question or two that I can take and respond to all together.
I'm just wondering, you know, when you're dealing with the government as it came to Germany, it might be convinced itself that, you know, a minority in its own society or, you know, immigration is a threat. What works? I mean, is it the power of the international community as represented in those international covenants? Is it, you know, from your experience, are there particular arguments and strategies that are effective in dealing with that kind of thing?
Yes?
I have a question about, I think,
Well, go ahead.
I was just wondering, if you could comment about Kosovo, because I'm thinking about, there you have the UN actually administering the province for a long period of time, and yet it seems, I was there in 2006, and I know that the position of minorities at that stage was very shameful still. I don't get the impression that things are much better now in 2008. So I'm wondering, with the fact that that was the UN administration for the period of 8 years, what steps they put in place, whether they put in any sort of strategy, and whether that might be useful in other areas where you talk about capacity in government, as for, you know, better governance. If the UN has done a good job of it, then who else will, or how will that build really up?
Let me say first, I am here on a what we call in the UN parlance a unofficial informal mission, which means that I will not make this the subject of a report to the Human Rights Council. But it will certainly be a topic of discussion with my colleague rapporteurs and with treaty bodies. And I've often been asked by treaty bodies as they take up countries that they think I might have some views on or knowledge of, to give them my views. I know that Australia is going to be before a series of treaty bodies over the next year. And so it's in those kinds of forums, informally, that I will give my views. I'm also very happy to with the choice of a new special rapporteur on Indigenous people's rights, who's just been named and will take office starting May, someone who I have known for many years and have a very close relationship to. And I certainly intend to make sure that there's a brain dump from me to him in terms of all of the things that I have learned here and have come to be quite concerned about. I'm not sure that I am fully clear about your question, whether you're asking about expertise in terms of negotiating with the government or negotiating the interaction with community people.
There's two parts of it, the education of the community people about where all those things fit and the types of negotiation platform we might build in relation to negotiating with government, and then, you know, it's and help with the negotiation strategy.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that one of the things that the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights has been working on, has been focused on, is what she calls a country engagement strategy. That seeks to bring those kinds of services, expertise, consultative, you know, trainings to the country level. Now, I don't think you have a office of the High Commissioner here in Australia, but they're very available to come and work with community groups and representatives of the community. I think that maybe afterwards we could talk about that. What works in with intransigent governments? I mean, I wish I had exactly the magic bullet to give to you. I think that, you know, there are some fundamentals about consultation with communities, about decision-making practices that guarantee that communities are in charge of decisions that are made about them. I think that there is international pressure. That's the role that I play a small part in. And going through, as Australia will over the next year, review before a number of different treaty bodies, I think there are going to be some consistent messages that the government will hear through that process that I think will be very useful. Of course, nothing changes in countries unless the population in that country makes change. You can't open the ears of government unless there is a national movement to do so. So that is, I think, the most fundamental.
I guess that's really what I was asking. I think I'm probably well aware of those national governments, but general population are, and how you make the connection between that, part of the pressure and, you know, sort of grounds, right? Whether the media plays an important role.
Well, the media, of course, plays an important role, but they rarely play this role. Although we have tried, they won't play that role. But I think community leaders have to, those in positions such as this institution have to empower people to talk to communities about these global standards, people at universities, lawyers groups, all need to be passing on the information about, you know, these standards, the procedures that go along with them, and how they connect to the real life issues that are on the ground. Now, you asked a very interesting question here on Kosovo. And You know, I have been in my career associated with a long line of countries management, you know, operations, country field operations, better you, and going all the way back to Namibia, which was the first one. I think there's some things that the UN does and does well. There's some things that the UN is not as equipped to do. And certainly the UN cannot be better at being government than, you know, body that comes from the ground, from people that has the national resources there, et cetera. UN can't do that. All the UN can do in situations like Kosovo is just sort of hold things together until a government can be formed. There were a lot of problems, and still are, in Kosovo. A lot of problems relating to minorities. I was involved in many cases in trying to get the administration there to do some things that I thought were right. They had limited capacity. Those are the realities. The one thing that both in my life as an NGO leader and as a UN person is that I just want to make sure that people understand that the UN is not coming to save them. That's actually not what this is about. The UN couldn't do it if they felt that it was, you know, a priority. They're not able right now to stop genocide in Darfur. So it's not that the UN administrations are stopgap measures where everything else has failed, and only until, you know, the legitimate governing force can be put in place. The reality is that's all you're going to get. Now, technically, the UN, I mean, there's been a decision by the International Court of Justice, the UN, and all multilateral international organizations are under obligations to abide by international human rights law. I mean, that's one level response to your question. But, you know, the reality is, you know, there have been multiple failures in that regard in all the countries where the UN is. So, just reality check here. Yes.
Do you think that sporting bodies have a role to play in diplomacy in relation to the oppression of human rights in minority bodies?
That what bodies have?
Sporting bodies.
Sporting bodies. Oh, I wonder what you're talking about.
Sporting bodies.
Well, you know, I don't know what you really mean by sporting bodies. You mean national sporting bodies. Let me put it. All human formations have a role to play. All of them can either contribute to the problem or contribute to the solution. I don't think any organization of human beings is outside the circle of responsibility just because they kick a football or run a fast mile or whatever. I think that we do have a responsibility, we the international community, all of us have a responsibility to see that every effort that is promoted by the international community is one which contributes to solutions and not to problems, which endorses going, you know, endorses governments that are not as intransigent as others. I think, you know, that there's just nobody outside the scope of responsibility, in my view. No entity, no organization.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. You talked about the cycle.
Can you speak up just a bit? Yeah, stand up maybe. Yeah.
You spoke about the relationship between minority groups and discrimination and disadvantage. If I just want to ask, what do you see any successful strategies that have succeeded in creating that cycle?
Between the cycle of minority groups and
discrimination and economic disadvantage.
Well, I mean, these things are processes, you know. And as they go, I probably, you know, there have been some development strategies that have been more useful than others. But in every case, it starts with the complete involvement of the community in shaping the strategies that lift out of poverty. And these are the communities that are rarely, if ever, consulted. So, you know, without trying to get into a treatise on economic development approaches or poverty alleviation strategies, let me say, if you don't ask the people involved, you're never going to actually get it right. And if you don't focus on the particularities of communities that are in poverty because of discrimination, then you're not going to reach them. People think, well, poverty is poverty. You just, you know, do some across the board, lifts all boats, and that'll lift, you know, the boat of communities that are facing a lot of discrimination as well. Well, I think that the evidence is in on that one. It doesn't work. So you've got to be willing to fashion targeted policies that deal with the particularities of discrimination. You've got to consult thoroughly and allow the community concerned to be an active a part of decision making. Those are the two sort of sine qua nons, I think, of that should be in all poverty alleviation strategies. You know, I just can't hear you. If you could stand up and project, maybe it's the air conditioner.
Sorry, I was just wondering how much the national voice has been enforced by the
Well, of course, it depends on the constitutional structure in or non-constitution in every country. I think that certainly where there is there are entrenched rights in a constitution of sorts, then the court's going to be able to play a better role. I think that where the constitutional arrangements are ones that automatically incorporate international obligations like human rights treaties into domestic law and accept them as creating causes of action, I think the courts are going to be better than where that doesn't exist. You know, I think that court systems, that judicial systems where the mentality of the judiciary is one which, where there is a sense of their role being to seek justice and not simply a formal role in applying some black letter, then I think domestic courts are going to be better than if that's not the case. But I must say that I don't think I had focused on it before coming here and preparing for this trip, but the structure here in Australia with no rights recognized as entrenched on a national level is one that I find quite curious. And I applaud the people of Victoria for passing a charter. I hope that their leadership in that regard will be followed at the federal level. I hope that it will eventually be a charter that actually creates a cause of action, so you know you don't have to sort of slide it in here or there or use it. I don't think there's any problem with the way the Victoria Charter is framed, so that it puts the action at the legislative process point. But ultimately, it seems to me that what really develops into a culture of rights is one where individuals and groups are empowered to drive it forward. And so an ability to go to court as an individual or a group or whatever and seek enforcement of the right, I think is a very important thing for popular education, for understanding of the system of rights. Okay. Have I finished? Okay, well, thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Gay. I think, I say on behalf of all of us that we've been honoured and privileged to have you to come and spend some time with us tonight, and not only with us here, but your time that you've spent in Australia sharing your knowledge and your experience with us, because I think it's invaluable in a lot of ways. As you know, the Herioc has had a very, very fruitful and long-standing relationship with Gay both in Durban and in Geneva. So that's good. But folks, can I just say also that whilst we're hosting it at Herioc tonight, we are one of but five sponsors of Gay's trip over here. The other parties who have shared in the responsibility to have Gay over here is Amnesty International, the International Law Centre at the University of Sydney, Sydney Democratic Forum, and the Human Rights Law Resource Centre in Victoria. And so on behalf of all of us, we thank you very much.